mic check, please.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Ducks Limit Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Jennings.
I'm your host, Dr. Mike Brazier.
My name is John Gordon. I'll be your host.
And I'm your host, Katie Burke.
Welcome to the Ducks Unlimited Podcast, the only podcast about all things waterfowl. From hunting insights to science-based discussions about ducks, geese, and issues affecting waterfowl and wetlands conservation in North America, we bring the resource to you, the DU Podcast.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. I'm your host, Mike Brazier, and joining me here in studio is my co-host, Chris Jennings. On the line, we have a guest that's going to help us with our continuing series, continuing coverage on Season in Review. We're going to be talking about the Pacific Northwest, and I'm happy to welcome in Kyle Spragans, the Waterfowl Section Manager for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Kyle, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Mike, and hey, Chris, how's it going?
It's going great, Kyle. Glad to have you.
I guess you've been on the podcast once before. We talked about something maybe a couple of years ago, but it's been a while, and we wanted to get you on to give us an update on the Pacific Northwest, sort of a season in review, I guess, more than an update. We spoke with a couple of folks throughout the season on how things were unfolding south of you there in California, and of course, drought and then flooding later in the winter was a big, were the two big topics there. But obviously, the Pacific Northwest, Washington, Oregon, those areas are waterfowling hotbeds in their own right. That Washington waterfowling, that secret that y'all have got up there is starting to get out. I can just tell you. So appreciate
not,
you.
Not sure what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would say.
So Kyle, I guess to start with briefly, just kind of give people an idea of what you do for the state, what kind of responsibilities you have, where you are, that type of stuff.
Yep, I work for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, so the state agency charged with those harvestable species and regulations around that. In Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife lingo, my title is the Waterfowl Section Manager. I coordinate sort of the statewide monitoring responsibilities, but also serve as the connection with the Pacific Flyway Study Committee, the technical arm in the Pacific Flyway that's looking at migratory game bird populations and topics and issues. And so I'm that go-between from the state to our federal and international partners in that realm. We have a variety of activities from banding to surveys that we conduct that are often complementing some of the sort of larger national surveys that folks are more familiar with, perhaps. And so, we do a lot of ground activity monitoring to try to feed into better informed decisions as it relates to waterfowl harvest management.
And so those kind of responsibilities allow you and require you to stay up to date, knowledgeable of the way things are unfolding habitat-wise, weather-wise, breeding conditions, wintering habitat conditions. I mean, that's kind of your thing, right? And so that's why we wanted to bring you on here to talk about it in the Pacific Northwest. And I guess to start with, we'll go back because we haven't given a whole lot of coverage to this recently. This is sort of where it all starts when we think about what the hunting season is going to be like or what the population is going to be like. It's sort of the breeding habitat conditions. And we have talked in the past, I guess last fall, about generally the areas that are important for producing ducks that make it to the Pacific Flyway. But we wanted to get your perspective on the key things that developed last year, what your expectations were and expectations of hunters as you entered the season with regard to, you know, production, fall flight. How were people preparing themselves in terms of what they might expect?
Yeah, good question. Well, as you alluded to, particularly in Washington, you know, we're keeping our eyes on several different regions. We do have local production, certainly for mallard and Canada geese and a variety of other species, but those are the two that are sort of the most predominant when we're doing our aerial surveys. But we're looking, you know, east of the prairies, you know, southern Alberta is certainly a big production area for mallard and pintail that are coming particularly into the east side of the state, the zone that most folks know as the Columbia Basin. We get a large number of birds that are coming down from central British Columbia, often that sort of Fraser Plateau, the upper part of the Fraser watershed is kind of forgotten in the mix of how much productivity actually comes out of that Intermountain region, and then of course to Alaska. And you know, I would say particularly in the west side of the state and down into places like the Willamette Valley, that production that's coming from Alaska, while most people are probably thinking of, you know, widgeon and pintail and green-winged teal as some of the big ones, the number of mallards that are coming down from Alaska certainly is felt in Washington, particularly around that Puget Sound, the lowlands, the low-lying areas around the Puget Sound. So with all that, certainly there was a lot of nervousness going into the season because we were in extraordinary drought on the east side. We had sort of epic rains on the west side, almost to the point of being detrimental from the timing standpoint. Just there was so much water so quickly that it was a little unclear how the west side was going to pan out. Obviously, the southern Alberta has been in sustained drought for quite some time, and we feel that certainly in the pintail, but in terms of numbers, but in terms of the harvest, it's felt from in the standpoint of, do you have a lot of naive mallards, young of the year mallards coming down, or are you dealing with a very, older group of birds? And so there was a lot of unknowns. We weren't particularly optimistic, with the one exception of there had been some decent numbers associated with Alaska. We just weren't sure what the productivity of that was going to translate to. But I guess the other indicator for us, while we do a spring breeding survey on both sides of the state, numbers were fairly average. There wasn't anything that stood out as extraordinary. But then we follow that up with our banding. We do have preseason mallard banding. And so we get a little bit of a sense of, well, how many young are winding up in these traps? And the general observation from the field was there wasn't a lot of young birds early in our trapping season, but as we got towards the later part, some young birds showed up. And of course, we don't really know if that means they're from Washington or if they're coming down from British Columbia or elsewhere. So,
Kyle, I want to stick with Alaska here briefly because I know there was a very significant weather system that came in and affected Alaska late summer, early fall, almost, if I'm remembering correctly, I heard some characterization of it as like almost hurricane strength and significant flooding in the YK Delta. And I think it's the YK Delta. You can correct me on that. Do you know if that had any effect on the production that ultimately made it south? Did it cause any mortality either in ducks or geese?
We heard a little bit of impact in terms of, flooding along like the margins of the YK Delta, Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, where a lot of the geese come from. It's harder to feel that in some of the duck species, I think. There was a little bit of hint that maybe that was going to, manifest in some sort of reduced, young goose flight, but it was a little unclear still in the ducks.
Yeah, okay.
But certainly those, that characterization, just the weather that happens, while we watch the drought maps often, it's often, a freak late rain or something in the summer that can really drive the trajectory a different way. We had that in eastern Washington, where a very late rain system came in and flooded out several of the sort of northeast rivers. And so the ducklings we were catching were still tiny, like two-day-old ducklings in the first week of July. So it was a very late nesting, timing in certain parts of the state. That was sort of the mixed bag. It was like it seemed like production was off early, but maybe there was a little bit of a second wave towards the end.
Hey, Kyle, I got a quick question. And this is kind of, our audience obviously is national, but, a majority of them are coming from the Mississippi and Central Flyway. And I think, and even myself, growing up and hunting in the Midwest, I had no idea what you guys out in Washington were doing. but I think for our audience, it'd be great for you to kind of explain the drastic differences in habitat types throughout the state from west to east. It goes pretty wild. And I think that's something for a lot of, our hunters where, you're talking about Kansas and Indiana and, it's pretty much the same throughout the entire state, other than small variants where you guys are dealing with drastic differences in habitat types. Can you kind of talk about that and just kind of describe what that looks like for our audience?
Sure. Yeah. I'll give it a try. no, that's right. Washington feels like two very different states, and that split comes as a result of the mountains that run down sort of the, not quite halfway, kind of the third of the state, the Cascade Mountain Range. And to the west of that, as it drops off into the Puget Sound and towards the Pacific Ocean, we're influenced by just constant rain pattern and precipitation coming off of the Pacific Ocean. And so, you know, that water availability on the west side is maybe a little more predictable. You know, when it actually comes is a little bit unpredictable, but that is what drives it. Between that and sort of the cold weather to the north in Alaska driving the migrants down. But we're talking about, you know, coastal rainforest. I mean, it is all about water, whether we're talking about tidal situations, salt marsh along the fringe of the Puget Sound or in the lower Columbia River, and, you know, anywhere into seasonal flooded marsh and agricultural fields, right? The sort of classic region people might be familiar with is the Skagit Valley up by the British Columbia border. It's a big agricultural zone for potatoes and barley and, you know, the sort of typical crops that you know, waterfowl and particularly geese certainly find food resources in. And so that's kind of a hot spot. And then that contrasts with the east side of the state, east of the Cascades, which is the Columbia River drainage or a big part of the Columbia River drainage. And so it's funneling a ton of water from both snowmelt, but also, or, you know, like snowpack water melt, but also just sort of big, vast open areas. The two that are kind of the ones that aren't well known kind of outside in the Columbia Basin are ones referred to as the Channeled Scablands, which is a landscape that's dotted with thousands of wetland depressions. We don't actually even know the true number. There's so many. But those wetland complexes are huge for things like redheads or cinnamon teal. You know, there's a production that is kind of hidden within that. But it's an arid landscape. It's a very low precipitation part of the state. And so you are talking about a lot more drier agriculture, open plains. And so that, you know, the wetland types over there are much more emergent freshwater marsh or the deeper waters of the Columbia River. And so we do get a variety of diving ducks that come into the Columbia River. But when you get into the heart of the winter in the Columbia Basin, you're really talking about the big birds that can hold on. And so largely that's mallards and Canada geese and not a whole lot of anything else on the east side. Whereas on the west side, we consistently have over 20 species of ducks that are making up the bag, right? From sea ducks to dabbling ducks and a whole variety. And so that is certainly driven by that underlying diversity of wetland types that we have that are very different in those two parts of the state. So
cool.
You can find whatever you're looking for. I guess that's the fun part of it.
Kyle, that's a great backdrop for my next question. And it relates to the effect of drought, that widespread Western drought, and which parts of the state it affected or did it affect. We've spoken with a number of people about the severity of the drought in California, and we know it was super severe throughout much of the Intermountain West. I'm not certain, though, how strong that drought was up in the eastern part of Washington. What can you tell me about that? And did you feel any effects of the drought once you got kind of west of the Cascades? I'm guessing there's not a whole lot of effect there, but at least in terms of the habitat conditions. But what can you tell me about how that drought may have shaped things in Washington?
Yeah, eastern Washington, as you allude to, so, you know, that divide in the state is also replicated in the two joint ventures, the two habitat joint ventures that Washington straddles, Pacific Bird Habitat to the west and the Intermountain West Joint Venture to the east. And so we were in exceptional drought in parts of the Columbia Basin. It wasn't quite as bad as two summers ago, but it was still at levels where, you know, in each of the descriptions of the type of drought or the drought classification, you know, they say sort of the common expectations, you know, crop failure and those types of things. And there were parts of the Columbia Basin that had hit the most exceptional level where they didn't have a description because they hadn't been there before. And so they didn't know what to expect. It was pretty concentrated, those types of real extremes, you know, because it is the Columbia River basically goes kind of around this large routing, and then there's an agricultural program, the irrigation project in the middle, that is what drives all the agriculture in the Columbia Basin. So because of that, there is sort of this constant source of water. It's just, where is the water actually being? And so whether or not, in those exceptional drought scenarios, that's where that dotted landscape of the channeled scablands, not as many wetland complexes are out there in those real dry years. And so you know that there's going to be some level of reduced productivity. And whether that's across the board or just delayed, this year what it seemed like was it was delayed. There was probably a sort of a second effort into June that was probably where we actually got young birds from. And so anyway, what's hard to gauge right now is that the timing of the rain. So right now, if you look at the drought map, Washington's actually in pretty good shape. We're probably almost all white. We're probably at almost zero, drought in the state at the moment. But this next 2 months, as we head into the breeding season, is what's going to make or break everything. And the pattern in the last couple of years is it suddenly goes dry for 2 months and we wind up, right back in the drought situation. So, we certainly, the vast majority of our local production is coming from the east side of the state, but certainly that's where the boom bust comes in. The west side stays more static. It's kind of very predictable of how many breeding pairs of mallards or something we're going to see on the west side of the state. The east side can have this wild fluctuation of the number of breeding pairs that we encounter on our surveys, depending on the availability of wetlands out there on that landscape. So.
Perspective as you got into the fall and winter, to kind of draw a comparison to what we saw in California, I guess it was they went into that hunting season super dry. They were concerned about waterfowl hunters even finding places to hunt. Some of the public areas didn't have all of their units and their spaces available for hunting because they just didn't have water. And so I'm curious if you all saw something similar in Eastern Washington, and did you get any of those? When did you start getting periods of rain relief, kind of similar to what California did?
Right. So, the West Coast, I think people are becoming a little bit more familiar with the term of the atmospheric rivers, right? The sort of the center punch focused rainfall that occurs, particularly in the fall time. And the part of that, it's a fire hose of water. And wherever that fire hose is hitting that year is where the water is going to get concentrated. And so 2 summers ago, the border between Washington and British Columbia, the Fraser Valley, was the center punch, right? And to the point where they had flooding and bridges getting washed out and railroads, getting carved out. So that was 2 years ago. This year, because it center punched on California, we were dry until well into November. And so, that the moisture kind of shifted south and we were sort of abnormally dry compared to what we would normally expect. So it took a while. It took a while for both West and particularly Western Washington to really get water on the landscape. And when that happens, birds are just really concentrated into whatever water is out there on the landscape. In the west side of the state, we have the sort of the backup system of the tidal waters, right? They can go out on the tidal flats and the protected bays, protected eelgrass bays and those types of areas, and kind of have sort of that secure backup plan wetland. In the east side, it was really sort of whatever wetland basins actually had water in it. That was pretty much where the birds were for several months until we finally got into some rains. It was really kind of in Thanksgiving time period, maybe even a little after that. It was pretty stalled out for a while. And meanwhile, it was getting cold to the north. And so when the north freezes, then you got even more birds coming into these concentrated areas. We see that most with the geese, like just visually, right? We know that geese are concentrated to these very limited, roost ponds that are out on the landscape. It's harder to kind of see it with the ducks, but it's definitely going on the same way. It was very limited in where there were actually wetlands available pretty much in up until about Thanksgiving time.
And so then things improved, and that moves birds around and gives people new hunting opportunities, much the same way that dynamic works in other landscapes. You think about cold temperatures, you think about new water, that moves birds and gets people excited. Same type of situation plays out there.
That's absolutely right. I mean, oftentimes it's kind of portrayed as the resident versus the migrant birds coming down. But really, it's more like what you just said is it's stirring the pot. You know, those birds are probably there. It's just that whether it's temperature or rainfall patterns have suddenly, provided availability or accessibility to foods that have been out there, but the birds just couldn't get to it, right? And so that spreads them out, it kind of opens up the breadth of who's actually getting opportunity for productive waterfowl hunting, right? Whether that's ducks or geese. And so, while it started slow and there was certainly concerns about, how much productivity was going to be coming down, it certainly picked up by Thanksgiving time. Certainly in December and January, we had a lot more water. There were a couple stall out periods, but in the east side of the state, that's where a lot of focus shifts towards hunting on the Columbia River, whether that's for diving ducks or some key areas where there's sort of concentrations of dabbling ducks that are going to move to that open water as the roost or whatever. And so, it started slow and a little bit, slow burn, but it definitely picked up. And I would say from all accounts, it seemed like we probably wound up closer to an average season than I think most people expected. Some people probably felt that differently in particular parts of the state. But, it sounded like folks that put in the time were definitely getting into some birds in all corners that we would expect them to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely pretty much answers my question that I had, was just based on the pace of the migration and how did it compare to other years? And you probably have to do that in an east-west fashion and probably separate it entirely. But how did it compare overall to, past years as far as just the pace of the migration? And you can separate ducks and geese too if you want to, but just kind of an overall, just a review there.
Well, the hidden secret part of Washington is we shoot a good number of ducks, right? Around 400,000 total duck harvest, but close to 50% of that is mallards, and that puts Washington up in the top five, sometimes top three, and in more recent years top two of mallard harvest in the nation. So mallard is a big component of that, followed by American wigeon. And so if you take those two species, that's about 2/3 of the entire duck harvest in Washington.
Man, that's a good 1-2 punch.
I have that on my list of notes here to ask you about. It just says wigeon ? So I didn't know where I was going with that, but I knew that you guys, just from looking at past harvest data, you can compare that. And it's just the wigeon harvest is pretty astounding. It's awesome.
There are a lot of hunters that would scratch and claw for wigeon and mallards to be 1 and 2.
Yeah, that's
right.
Secret. And we're going to have to edit that out.
Yeah. Well, so that's what plays out. On the west side of the state, it's probably more of a mixture of mallard and wigeon and the other, the other dabbling ducks that kind of feed into that pintail and green-winged teal. On the east side of the state, it's pretty much mallard focused because of just the surrounding agriculture and the wetland types. It's, mallard and Canada goose is by far the most predominant harvest over in the Columbia Basin, unless you go looking for some of those other birds like diving ducks on the Columbia River. So because of that, yes, you feel it. They kind of feel it differently. And, those wigeon on the west side of the state are very associated with Alaska. So until that push kind of comes from Alaska, there's not a huge number, but they do arrive fairly early. We see some initial pulses of pintail and wigeon by mid-August even, starting to come down the flyway. But you don't get into the bulk of it until maybe, early October or something like that, where you get the peaks really starting to come down. So, and then in terms of geese, that sort of difference in diversity of species also pans out. On the east side of the state, it's very Canada goose focused. There has been increasing snow geese in the last 10 years. And so there's been sort of a new opportunity over there that folks are getting into. But on the west side of the state, that's where that complex of all the different subspecies of Canada and cackling geese all kind of merged together. There are hot spots for snow geese, particularly up in that Skagit Fraser zone. And then the other one in the west is Brant. Brant's a big opportunity in four specific kind of coastal bays of Washington. It's a very limited season, but that sort of mixture of opportunity is what kind of spreads out the harvest pressure on the west side a little bit better. So
yeah, I know we're joking around about letting the secret out about Washington. You know, we've kind of talked about that for the last few years around here, especially. But I know a lot of people, even this year, who primarily hunt in Arkansas, but this year they took a trip out to Washington. Are you seeing that in your non-resident waterfowling licenses? Is that showing up? Are you guys like, oh yeah, people are kind of recognizing Washington as a real waterfowler's paradise now?
Where we've seen it pick up is we have a couple instances where we have mandatory harvest reporting just because the traditional ways of keeping tabs on harvests pick up numbers well, both for total mm-hmm. harvest and sort of the hunting effort, I guess, you know, number of hunters and hunter days. So in those cases, we do have a way to kind of more directly see, oh yeah, there's definitely an uptick in the non-resident numbers. And sometimes it's not the numbers that are so much so drastic, although there has been an uptick. It's sort of the spread of states that we see it from, right? So I think mm-hmm. I don't think I pulled it yet for this year, but last year I think out of the non-resident those cards that we could see, the non-resident affiliation, it was something like 24 different states represented there. We know that. We know just because of the diversity of species that are here. Oftentimes it's easier to get to Washington than Alaska. And so that we know that that's kind of a tendency. And we also know that there's some species that, are hard to come by or even think about coming by in other parts of the country. And so we know that that's, a potential. And that's where some of those species we keep kind of a closer tab on is important, because it can go sideways really quickly sometimes. But
Kyle, do you guys have any late season goose opportunities open right now in your state?
We do. I mentioned the sort of expansion of white geese. So the white geese, largely almost exclusively snow geese in Washington, are almost exclusively associated with the Wrangel Island population in eastern Russia. And so that population has been growing really quickly in the last decade. It's also been expanding in terms of where some of those the traditional versus sort of new winter areas to expect them to be at. And so, Washington in particularly has rapidly gone through a series of liberalizing the bag opportunity. And that has included pushing some season days, I should say shifting season days from that sort of typical mid-October to the end of January period into days either in February or even as late as March. Not too many days in March, but the point being there's two specific zones, one up in that Skagit where there's a very short white goose opportunity. There's also a white goose opportunity in the Columbia Basin that's going on right now. And then down in that southwest corner where we have the mixture of Canada and cackling goose subspecies, there is a late opportunity down there trying to kind of offset some of the agricultural concerns and issues that happen down in that zone.
So Kyle, I'm curious that the Pacific Flyway does not have access to the light goose conservation order, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. So then those hunting season dates into February and even early March for geese are available because that's what the Migratory Bird Treaty Act allows, that larger framework allows that hunting. It basically prohibits hunting between March 10th and September 1st or something of that nature, right? So in theory, that's what gives you the ability to do that. And that's different for ducks right now, right? Because there was a recent change to a piece of legislation that said duck seasons have to close by January 31st. Is that right?
That's correct. So the overarching bounds that exist are about that September 1st to March 10th. That's what's in Migratory Bird Treaty and the convention language and has been reflected in federal law. There are then frameworks that are specific to some of the types, you know, whether we're talking about ducks or geese. And as you just alluded to, for ducks, yes, there was a hard written amendment that basically said duck hunting may not go past January 31st in any of the flyways, with the exception of, you know, like youth or veteran and active military hunts, special hunt dates. The part that's important there and how this plays out differently in the Pacific Flyway sometimes is because of that 107 days, you know, that part of that rule is you may not invoke more than 107 days towards any species in any geographically defined area. That's why we have duck zones and goose management areas or goose zones, so that you can kind of shift that a little bit depending on where you are in the state, but you cannot exceed that 107. And so in the Pacific Flyway, to put days, you know, because we tend to open mid-October or somewhere in there, depending on the state, that run 107 days runs to the end, last weekend of January. And so to put days into February or even up to March 10th, that's why I said shifting. We actually have to take days out and put them out towards the end and kind of place those days, try to align those days as best as we can with the opportunity in terms of when we know snow geese are likely to come into one of those zones. And all that is because of exactly what you said. The Pacific Flyway is not part of, was never part of the conservation order. That was not an option in the Pacific Flyway. And so that means we still have to abide by the rules of the 107 days and the September 1st to March 10th, you know, realm. So yeah, it takes a little bit more strategizing, I guess, of like, well, when's our best use of those days? Especially if we're trying to use it as a tool to up harvest rate on an increasing population of snow geese off of Wrangell Island or something like that. So,
well, I appreciate you answering that question. It just occurred to me as we were listening to you talk, and I try to kind of put myself in the mind of some of our listeners, and they may be wondering about some of those things that you were talking about, and I just wanted to kind of clarify that. The other thing that they may be some may be wondering about is, how does the Pacific Flyway get 107 days?
I was going to say, there's somebody sitting around here in Mystery Flyway. Yeah.
They get to hunt for 107 days.
That is a topic for another day, and we actually did talk about that a little bit with Dale Humberg a number of episodes ago, maybe mm-hmm. even in the first year, but we've not done Jim Dubovsky, maybe it was Jim, but we've not done a deep dive on the history of that, and we're not going to do that here. So
I was going to say, I was like, man, that's going to be a good one.
No.
happy to talk about that, but you know, the one thing I will say about the ducks though is, you know, the part that gets kind of awkward is because of that 107, because we max out the 107 to provide those special dates, the youth hunt and the vet and active military hunt, that comes as sort of a penalty to the regular season. We have to take days out of the regular season, close it down. So for example, Washington has a 2-day closure in the middle of the season to afford that opportunity to have the youth in the vet hunt, because we max out the 107. The other flyways, because there's still room between whatever it is they're offering and 107, they can just add additional days, mm-hmm. right? So that gets sticky, because it gets into these interesting conversations about, well, who is that day more valuable for, right?
Yeah. So, good stuff. Yeah. There's a lot of nuance, and, you know, I don't want to say complexity. Some would describe it as complexity, but there's just a lot of different things that you have to work around in a lot of those, the regulations that you set across the flyways. And so those are always great discussions, but we'll move on here. Kyle, appreciate you answering some of those questions there. One of the other sort of prevailing topics across this waterfowl season was avian flu. And I know that you guys saw it out there as well. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about that, how it unfolded in your state and what you heard from some of your Pacific Flyway colleagues. When did it first start to show up? What were the primary species? When did you see, or did you see, it begin to wane? Give us that sketch of how it unfolded.
Certainly. Yeah, we saw it most in the geese. I guess that was the most direct observation. And that was because there was some level of mortality in the geese. Now, there's been a lot of argument about, well, is that high mortality, or is that, you know, what is that level? You see dead birds. You don't always see, you know, a bird that's sick and then recovers, right? And so in terms of timing and the species, the first real indication was around about Halloween time. So end of October, down along the lower Columbia River, there were some dead cackling goose, minima the smallest one, smallest cackling goose. There was a die-off down there, several hundred, if not into the low thousands, that were being, you know, either observed or picked up, or each state kind of dealt with it a little bit differently. So that was in that sort of late October period. That kept going into November, but started fizzling out. About that time, when that sort of fizzle out further north, up in that northwest corner of Washington, the Skagit-Fraser, there were two spots that really flared up with snow geese. We started picking up a bunch of dead snow geese on the landscape. In the one instance, it was well over 700 birds that we actually picked up. And then the other instance was actually on one of the bays. And so the birds that would die would then get moved around by wind and tide and current. And so we were picking birds up all over the place. The commonality there was, at that time, as I mentioned, there had not been much rain on the landscape. There was not a lot of water out on that landscape. And so those instances that we were picking up, particularly these concentrations of dead geese, were all on roosts. They were all on night roosts, where the birds were in high aggregated flocks for long extended periods of time, right? And so if you play out the probability game of a virus has to jump to a new host and somehow keep finding that, well, that's one spot to do it, is a high aggregation roost site. We were seeing some other, you know, species in the mix that we were picking up mortalities, but certainly the geese were the most prevalent. So that northwest corner, that was kind of more in that mid to late November time period, and that kind of fizzled out in the early part of December, and then sort of it picked up over on the Columbia Basin side and even over into some parts of kind of the Idaho-Oregon border a little bit later than that. And so, but in all of those cases, it was, again, where these sort of big roost aggregations are occurring. And when I say that, with the snow geese for us, you know, those roosts could be anywhere from 10,000 to 60,000 birds packed into one little spot, right? And so it's a lot of individuals that if even just a handful are sick, then, you know, the potential of something going wrong could. Now, you know, the reality is while we picked up something like 1,000 birds or so up in that northwest corner, you know, our annual harvest is something like 8,000 to 10,000 birds, right? And so it was well below sort of a number that was causing us pause, but it certainly wasn't comfortable, you know, having to go and pick up a, you know, dead geese up in those areas during the season, right? So
once you got into mid-December, late December, did you see the number of cases begin to drop off the way we did and the way I'm hearing about in other areas?
It's been real quiet. I mean, we did have, that was about the time where we did start getting a lot more water on the landscape, so that certainly helped. But just in general, yeah, the sort of number of reports that we were getting from either field staff or members of the public calling in observations definitely declined by that sort of mid-December period. We just really hadn't heard too much since then. And, you know, at the same time, I know that USDA was doing their, you know, hunter swab surveillance that was still ongoing in certain watersheds that had been selected. And they were getting detections of birds in the hunter harvest. But, you know, again, it's sort of this game of, well, we think there were just a lot of asymptomatic birds that survived, right? Like, we think there was actually, it was there. We know it was there. It was just sort of how much did it impact birds. We saw it in the mortality of some geese, but we didn't really see that same sort of parallel in some of the duck species. We didn't come across big, you know, die-offs of ducks. So still some question marks.
One piece of information I'll pass along to you. We just today, the day that we're recording this with you, which is February 15th, we released an episode giving an update on avian flu. One of the pieces of information that we passed along in that episode came from Dr. Dave Stalnack, the Southeastern mm-hmm. Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study. And they had collected a small number of birds from Louisiana and conducted some blood tests on them to look for antibodies, and they found antibodies for an H5 type virus. They couldn't dial it into this specific strain that we know is out there, at least not with that testing. They may be doing some more. But anyway, at least at the initial test, they did find somewhere north of 60% of that sample had circulating antibodies for an H5 type of virus. So to your point, yeah, you know, kind of what you were saying, that's what we thought happened. That's what you kind of described. It probably were a lot of birds that did get it. And because you can't, just knowing that ecology and the biology of those species and of the virus itself and those 10 to 60,000 snow geese in that concentrated area, you know there's a lot of transmission of the virus. Right. And so we're starting to get some data that is, I guess, painting a picture of what may have happened in some of those cases. But then, of course, what happens from here, oh, we'll just have to wait and see.
Right. And that's where that sort of discussion around the mortality gets difficult, because we have a number of the number of birds that we pick up, but to really know what that is in reality, you'd have to know, well, how many birds got sick, right? And that's the unknown that we don't have. And so is it 1% mortality or, you know, some bigger number? We just don't have that denominator to feel comfortable about making some sort of statement like that. So it's very interesting to hear the results of that study, because exactly right. I mean, it kind of confirms the thought of, well, if birds are concentrated in small spots in that early part of the year, I don't see how it wouldn't have circulated, right? And so, yeah, it's great to have some science backing that up.
Anything else from you, Chris? Kyle, I think we're about to wrap it up here. Any other high points or any notable observations from this hunting season or where you are now that you want to make people aware of, or any kind of message for your hunters or folks up there in the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, you know, I think overall it was slightly better than what we expected. I think it was probably a fairly average season overall, which you know, I don't think we were particularly surprised going into it with all the drought concerns and just sort of discomfort around productivity. You know, I did mention that we do band a good number of mallards in Washington. And so there was a steady trickle throughout the season of recoveries, right? And so certainly people were getting into birds. How many people were getting into them? You know, it's always hard to tell from that. But we're hoping that, you know, we're hoping this next 2 months that there's still precip that comes and sets us up for a decent breeding season ahead. And we'll be out there surveying and in the aircraft when it gets to that time. So we're glad that, you know, that things panned out a little bit better than we had hoped for, and hopefully folks made the most of it where they could.
Kyle, thanks so much for being with us here and sharing perspective from the Pacific Northwest. It's always great to connect with you.
Yep, thanks,
Absolutely.
Kyle.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
A special thanks to our guest on today's episode, Kyle Spriggins, the Waterfowl Section Manager for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate his time and insight on all things waterfowl as it played out this past season. As always, let me thank my co-host here, Chris Jennings, for joining us here and asking some good questions as well. As always, we thank our producer, Chris Isaac, for the great work he does. And we thank you for joining us and for your support of wetlands and waterfowl conservation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the DU Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show. And visit www.ducks.org/DU Podcast for resources based on today's topics, as well as access to more episodes. Opinions expressed by guests do not necessarily reflect those of Ducks Unlimited. Until next time, stay tuned to the ducks.
Stay tuned to the ducks.